Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
The New Statesman.
1 week ago, Hamza Yousaf, First Minister of Scotland and leader of the Scottish National Party, terminated the power-sharing deal with the Scottish Greens. There had been mounting pressure on both Yousaf's leadership and ending the coalition, but the eventual timing of the termination caused the now former leader to appear panicked and triggered a Scottish government crisis. On Monday, after just 13 months in office, Yousaf resigned ahead of 2 no-confidence votes. This morning, John Swinney announced his leadership bid to be Scotland's next First Minister. Meanwhile, Kate Forbes is set to make an announcement on her decision to run this afternoon. But the SNP was deeply fractured when Yousaf inherited it. Would a successor be able to unite it? Hello, I'm Rachel Cunliffe, Associate Political Editor at The New Statesman, and you're listening to The New Statesman podcast. I'm joined today in the studio by our political correspondent, Freddie Hayward. And down the line in Stirling, we have Chris Deering, The New Statesman's Scotland editor. And we're going to be going over the past tumultuous week in Scottish politics, what it means for the SNP and for the country's political future. Chris, should we just start with why Yousaf had to end the power-sharing deal with the Greens? What happened? What brought all of this chaos about?
Well, it's been coming for a while, I think, and Yousaf had probably resisted the idea longer than he should have. So you'll be aware that over the last maybe 18 months or so, even before Nicola Sturgeon went, a lot of the policies that had been shared between the SNP and the Greens had gone quite spectacularly wrong and contributed quite significantly to the SNP's decline in the polls. There was a real sense that the green tail was wagging the yellow SNP dog and that the Greens were getting a lot more out of the coalition than the SNP were. The SNP membership had become increasingly unhappy at this, at the focus on some of the sort of social wokery, put that in inverted commas, that the Greens were pushing, and increasingly the SNP backbenchers at Holyrood and the MPs at Westminster, who, you know, are facing a bit of a thumping in the general election at Labour's hands, were also pretty unhappy. So I think Yousaf, having defended that coalition almost on a daily basis since he took over, but not really having much political sense, decided that he had to save his skin by getting rid of them. And so he announced that without realising that the numbers would no longer add up in Parliament if it came to a no-confidence vote, which the Tories promptly called. And it became clear over the weekend that Yousaf was going to lose that no-confidence vote, and therefore he was forced to stand down. So the author of his own misfortune, a complete cock-up, one of the great, spectacular pratfalls in modern British politics.
What's that phrase? The first rule of politics is learn to count.
Too late now.
So where do the Greens stand now in relation to the SNP? How might this look going forward?
So the Greens now find themselves outside of the coalition. I think the SNP no longer look very kindly on them at all. Those who didn't before look less kindly on them now, but the fact that they've brought down an SNP First Minister means that relations between the two parties, which were relatively good in areas for a long while, are now pretty awful. The SNP will now govern as a minority administration, and as we'll get onto with John Swinney's announcement that he's running today, they're looking at how they're going to do deals with different parties across the parliament. So I suspect the SNP are quite happy in a sense that they're free now to move away from some of those that policy agenda I mentioned earlier that had got them into some trouble with the electorate, and perhaps they can align a bit more closely with the voters' concerns about the cost of living crisis, about the state of public services, about an economy that isn't performing as well as it should be. And they'll be hoping that by doing that, they can start to reverse the poor fortunes in the polls we've seen in recent months.
Chris, you're speaking about the Greens. I mean, have we not seen in the past week the splitting of the nationalist movement? We've had the SNP leadership try and bring the Greens on board, and then Hamza Yousif admitted that he underestimated how annoyed they'd be. They also flirted with the idea of trying to win over Ash Reagan from the Alibi Party, and all of they're the three main nationalist parties, all of whom are now disagreeing with one another, briefing against each other. I mean, where does this leave the nationalist movement as a whole?
Well, I think that's maybe where we come on to John Swinney's campaign launch this morning. He's announced he's going to run to be SNP leader and First Minister. And his message was very much one of unity in the independence movement. When it came down to it, given where they were, and as you point out, Freddie, the split between the three aspects of the independence movement, Alibi, the SNP and the Greens, who all really stand for slightly different things and have that shared passion for independence. I think John Swinney, probably because he's probably the most respected figure still across the independence movement. He's well-liked. He's modest. He's self-effacing. He's thoughtful. And, he's been committed to the independence cause for his entire adult life. You know, he's been at the forefront of the SNP for really since the early 1990s. So no one doubts his commitment, and everyone likes him. And therefore, putting him in as First Minister, as SNP leader, I think is the one option they have that stands a chance of maybe keeping the Greens on board for certain areas where they can win votes in Parliament. And, you know, the Alibi thing is a slightly different thing because it's much more antagonistic due to the problems with that, with Alex Salmond. But the independence movement more broadly, I think, will maybe accept that Swinney is the balm, the ointment that the split and wounded movement needs at the moment. So it's probably the one option that was available to them. Had they gone for Kate Forbes, and we're recording this before Kate Forbes has said whether she's going to run or not, I'm pretty sure she's not going to run, especially, we can come on to this, what John Swinney said about her in his leadership launch. Had it been Kate Forbes, that would obviously have caused huge amounts of problems with the Greens and the progressives, self-styled progressives within the SNP, who have got a problem with her views on social policy. So when you look at who's available, I think at this stage, it probably makes sense for John Swinney, so coronation or not, to be the one who comes in and just tries to heal those quite deep wounds that have been caused over the last couple of years.
Yeah, just on some of those policies, because they've also been central to the conversation and the debate and what's happened in the past week. I mean, I've been speaking to Westminster SNP MPs for months, and they've been saying that it seems as if the Holyrood government are diverting or moving away from what they would describe as the people's priorities. We've had the new hate crime, the hate speech law that's come in. They had the sort of transgender debacle. The Greens have obviously pushed much more tough environmental laws. I mean, where does policy fit in here? I mean, it was interesting, as you said, John Swinney in his speech earlier, he did make, or at least alluded to that point. He said that we need to focus back on people's priorities. And, you know, he's asked about whether a trans woman was a woman. And he completely dismissed it out of hand as not being where politics should be right now. I mean, so yes, where the policy sit in this debate?
Yeah, so, you know, the SNP have been talking about a reset really since Nicola Sturgeon stood down, and Hamza Yousif talked about that, but yeah, Never really got going or got enough of a grip to deliver it. I think he just tried to keep everyone happy and ended up making no one happy. I think the Nats probably realised this is the last chance for them to make the change that needs to be changed. You know, those latter Sturgeon years of, progressive social policy, and really not having much to say about the state of our schools, despite the fact that, you know, the last PISA results, the International Comparator Study, showing Scotland's schools declining, the performance there. Our NHS data is awful as it is down south, but it's bad up here. The cost of living crisis has been a problem. And you can only blame Westminster for everything for so long. But when, you know, people start to notice that you're taxes in Scotland are considerably higher and the public services are not commensurately higher, and wonder what's being done with the money and why you're publishing constantly new papers on independence and what it would mean for public services, they're starting to wonder, well, why are you not doing anything about public services now? So I think that's what we heard from John Swinney today. He talked about, you know, ministers being focused on delivering services on which the public depend, health, education, housing, transport, so that people can see their lives are getting better. They're clearly hearing what the electorate is saying to them. And Swinney was quite robust on that, whether they're going to deliver it or not, because obviously, you know, a change of direction in government and you know, the reform of public services is not an easy thing to do. It requires some difficult decisions to be taken. You're probably going to have to disappoint some people. You're going to have to take on some vested interests. You know, the SNP have had 17 years to do that, and really they've backed down whenever that possibility has occurred. So we'll see. You know, we're used to, we've been through a few SNP first ministers now, and, you know, they've all talked tough. The rhetoric's been one thing, but the reality has been something quite different. So, you know, I thought John Swinney was quite impressive this morning, but, you know, if it's him, then let's see what he does in practice. I think we're all beyond the, giving people the benefit of the doubt. We want hard realities now.
Yeah, Chris, you wrote for the New Statesman earlier this week, now comes a choice between ideology and political good sense. And I think you've sort of summarised that dilemma for the SNP and their leadership and where they go from here in terms of the focus on independence versus the focus on governing with the devolved powers that they already had. On devolution and independence, Freddie, you got a scoop this week about the whether devolution could kill the SNP.
Yeah, I did a fascinating interview with George Robertson, who is now a Labour peer, but he used to be Labour's shadow Scottish Secretary back in the 90s. And he had this famous quip, this famous comment in 97, just before the campaign got kicking off, and he was defending devolution. And people were saying, well, won't that give a platform to the SNP? And he said, no, devolution will kill the SNP stone dead. Obviously, this has been thrown back at him and been much mocked because obviously the SNP has been in government in some form since 2007. And so I thought it'd be interesting to put it to him. And I think he's been waiting 25 years to say this. But he said, well, I may be proved right. You know, the reason that the SNP is struggling so much now is their inability to use the instruments of devolution. So his point essentially is that devolution has exposed the SNP for being this party that's obsessed with independence at the expense of governance.
And all of this is great for Scottish Labour, right?
I mean, I think it is. I mean, my initial reaction was, oh no, this is Liz Truss, you know. What Labour really should be doing is try to keep Hamza Yousaf in power for as long as possible, in the same way that I think if they kept Liz Truss in power for longer, then it would have been better. But, you know, I don't think it's harming Labour at Westminster that Liz Truss is gone. And I think probably in Holyrood, it'll be the same. But let's see. I mean, if I think Chris alludes to a good point earlier. I mean, is John Swinney a much better fit for the SNP and for the nationalist movement right now than Hamza Yousaf was? I mean, from what we've seen today, I think that's definitely the case.
And there was talk earlier of Scottish elections if Labour were successful in a vote of no confidence in the Scottish government, and obviously it would be in Scottish Labour's favour to have that election early rather than in 2026,
yeah,
where we will have had, assuming that the polls are right, we'd have had over a year of Starmer being Prime Minister. And I think there were sort of, it would be beneficial for them to have that election before the country has had a chance to get disappointed in Starmer rather than afterwards.
Yeah, some Scottish Labour people have been saying that in the past week. We've got to remember that the Scottish elections work on a slightly different system. They're much more similar to the Fixed Term Parliament Act that we used to have in Westminster. So it's slightly different to, you know, Rishi Sunak calling an election and the speculation over whether he'll do so right now. Yeah, of course, people in Labour are concerned that there's going to be this backlash against Keir Starmer's government. They are going to have, you know, potentially a honeymoon period at the start. And I think Scottish Labour are concerned that will negatively impact them down the line. You know, it might actually prove their point, that, and then maybe they can point to Keir Starmer and some of the policies that they've introduced, particularly if they have a good first 100 days in Westminster. But let's see. I mean, I don't think that's not the key thing.
After the break, we'll discuss what all of this means for the future of Scottish independence. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And Chris, where do you think this leads the independence movement, the chances of independence, another referendum in the immediate and then medium long-term future?
Well, there isn't going to be a referendum in the near future. And I think the SNP are starting to shift to maybe a more honest conversation with their own membership about that. I mean, John Swinney's slogan under which he's running is Uniting for Independence. So it's not, you know, they're not talking about it. No one would expect the SNP not to talk about independence. It's the reason they exist. The rest has been sort of larded on top because they need policies to run a devolved government. But, you know, he talked a bit about, I think, reaching out with respect and courtesy to address the obstacles in the way of winning the case for independence. There's no better way than that to build the levels of support necessary to win independence. You know, and we've heard bits of that before, but I think him saying that as the person who will be the next SNP leader sends a message to the movement and also probably to wider Scotland that there is a conversation to be had, that the SNP are maybe starting to accept that, you know, the opportunity in this political cycle to have another referendum has gone, that there'll be a degree of humility in the way they approach trying to build support for independence and the timescale for that. Again, the proof will be in the pudding, but certainly the language and tone that were used by John Swinney today were a little bit different from, you know, I think even at the sort of, in his resignation speech, Hamza Yousaf was saying that independence was tantalisingly close, which nobody thinks, you know, not even Hamza Yousaf thinks that, he said it. So getting away from that rhetoric, that spin, marching people up the hill with nothing to deliver them to them at the top is quite important for the SNP now. They felt very out of touch with the realities on the ground for quite a long time. And I get the feeling that John Swinney's personality and his own approach to things means that there'll probably be a more grown up and more honest conversation about all of that stuff now.
I mean, just on that, Chris, I found it remarkable that Hamza Yousaf had this quite long speech, and he essentially spent 20 minutes or whatever it was speaking about himself and how he feels about it and how proud he was to have, you know, had the opportunity to represent his country as First Minister. There was nothing really about what he's done, what he's achieved, the problems, where there was no sense of culpability or, I was dealt a bad hand, but I've also played it very poorly. And it made me think, and also some of your columns recently have made me think about the comparison between the SNP and the Conservative Party. And it seems as if they're both at this end of this long period in government. They are obsessing over themselves rather than the country. The narrative is slightly removed from where the broader political landscape is. And I was wondering, what do you think? Is that a fair comparison, or is that just me being a Westminster-centric political journalist?
No one would ever accuse you of that, Freddie.
well, from a Holyrood-centric political journalist, let me come back on that. There's an inevitability to that, isn't there? I mean, you could have made the same accusation against Labour in the late 2000s. You know, when you've been in government for ages, you know, and you've run through your major talent pool and you've tried to, bring in all of your early ideas, and some of them have worked and most of them have failed, and you're trying to reinvent the wheel, and the electorate are sick of you, and, you know, you're surrounded by scandals and the rest of it, and the data that's coming out suggests you're not really performing particularly well. That's what happens to long-serving governments. And at that point, you know, you tend to get divided parties, you tend to get blame being thrown around, and, you know, you tend to change leaders and hope for something that probably isn't going to arrive, some sort of, you know, knight on a white horse that's going to make everything like it was back in the glory days. And it doesn't really happen. And so things are ending for the SNP, assuming that John Swinney isn't going to magically turn things around, which, let's be honest, he isn't. Much as the way they're ending for the Tories, much as the way they ended for the Labour Party, much as the way they ended for the Tories in the John Major years, you know, there's a cycle to these things, and that's what we're seeing. The SNP have done well to defy that gravity for so long, partly because of their own tight unity and because they had this one cause of independence that kept them really tight for much longer than most parties would. But that's gone now, partly because of the decisions that Nicola Sturgeon took on social policy, which did divide a party. It's the next 2 years will be very painful for them. The general election will be a painful experience. Labour are probably going to thump them in Scottish seats. Holyrood election might be a bit closer, but, you know, when you're on the outs, it becomes very hard to persuade voters that they should take a fresh look at you and actually single. We were wrong to think that you had been in power for too long. We're actually going to put you back in for another 5 years, which will give you, you know, a quarter of a century unbroken in power. That's a big ask of any electorate, especially when you've had all the problems that the SNP have had, both in policy terms and police investigations and leaders who weren't up to it and all the rest.
And then, and Chris, where does this lead Kate Forbes? She came very close in the last leadership contest. She's spoken about as someone who could reinvigorate the party. It seems as if she's not going to stand. John Swinney, in his speech today, held out a hand to her and said that she would be central to his government if he did win. And it's also interesting that there is this sort of debate about whether she's the right age and whether it makes sense for her career to wait, let the losses come, and then come back in later. I mean, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, so I am pretty respectful towards Kate Forbes. I've written pieces in the past, certainly when she was running against Humza Yousaf, saying I thought she was the better option, and she's a very, very talented politician. She's very bright. She's got very good policy ideas. You don't have to agree with everything she believes to think that on maybe the reform of public services and on the economy that she's pointing in the right direction and had the abilities and skills to maybe start to make a difference there. However, I think when it became clear that John Swinney was going to run, you know, and assuming Kate Forbes hasn't announced she's going to run, which I think is highly unlikely at this stage.
Set my phone.
Yeah. I think when John Swinney decided he was going to run, it would have been slightly kind of kamikaze for Kate to take him on. He is the most popular person in the SNP. I don't think anyone would really have been able to beat him amongst that younger generation at this point. And the problem for Kate Forbes would have been, you know, she ran against Humza Yousaf and lost narrowly. She ran against John Swinney and lost, which she would have done. What happens then in a few years when the leadership comes up again? You end up being the Ken Clark of the SNP, where you keep running and keep losing. Despite the fact that lots of people think you might be quite good at the job, the membership won't have it. And you just becomes sort of diminishing returns every time you go for it. You know, you come that little bit further behind the leading pack. So I think if she's tucking in behind Swinney, and as he said, you know, he wants her to play a significant part in his team. She's an intelligent, creative, thoughtful person who's got much to contribute to her national life. And he said, if I'm elected, I'll make sure Kate's able to make that contribution. So I presume from that, if a deal's been done, she's going to get quite a big job in a John Swinney cabinet, whether that's in the economy or in one of the big spending ministries, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, from her perspective, that allows John Swinney to take the SNP through the next two difficult elections. If at that point he resigns or stands down, you know, she will be able to run again, having had longer in government to prove herself, or otherwise some of the other candidates who are of a similar generation to Kate, like Jenny Gilruth and Neil Gray and Mary McCallan, will have done the same. And, you know, there'll be a proper generational shift then. But it means Kate Forbes would be coming at that election pressure rather than someone who had been through two and been beaten in both of them, you know, and tarnished her brand in a sense. So I suspect that was her thinking in it, that she couldn't win. And if she ran and was beaten, she wasn't really doing herself any favours in the longer term.
But even if she doesn't run, she's not going anywhere.
No, and she hasn't gone anywhere. She's been very sort of intellectually active on the back benches since Humza Yousaf won. And as I say, it looks like she'll be back in the cabinet in some form or another under a John Swinney administration. So there's a chance for her to maybe try and take on some of the people in the party who haven't, you know, been on her side, and maybe prove to them that she is, you know, less to be feared in terms of her social views and whatever, and her actions than they seem to think she is. But that'll be up to her to do that over the coming few years.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us from Scotland, and Freddie, thanks for joining us in the studio. Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. If you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Rachel Cunliffe, and my colleagues, Freddie Hayward and Chris Dearen. We'll be back tomorrow with our polling expert, Ben Walker, to go over the results of today's elections. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello
Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.